You've probably been urged in recent years to know more about where your food comes from. We went from a time where nearly half the country lived on farms to now, when people can go an entire lifetime never seeing a farm. Our guest this hour grew up on a farm, left and came back, and changed things in many ways. Bob Quinn now farms ancient wheat organically in Montana. How we got to this point is the story he tells with Liz Carlisle in the book Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. Bob Quinn is a farmer and the owner of a PhD in plant biochemistry from UC Davis, and he has a lot of ideas about the conduct of agriculture in America today. Liz Carlisle is both a writer with a PhD in geography and a country music singer-songwriter. She joined us a few years back with another book from the farm called Lentil Underground. Bob Quinn is our solo guest. Hi, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be here.
I noticed elsewhere your farm seems to be turning into a centennial farm this year. How many generations is that of Quinns on that land?
Well, my grandfather started it in 1920, so next year is our centennial year.
Okay, congratulations.
My father came after him, and I'm the third one now.
Okay, three generations on the family farm there. Your first words in the book are, "I remember the day I stopped trying to grow food on the cheap." Liz, in her part of the book, says you wanted to get away from cheap food and fuel and labor. Why?
Well, because I couldn't make a living with that. We were paying more and more for inputs, for chemical inputs, and when the commodity prices went down, we weren't able to even pay our bills. And I felt there needed to be a better way than just going to town and getting another job.
Your observation is that cheap stuff is not really cheap. In what ways does it provide costs to us in ways besides the dollars?
Well, first of all, to the farmers, because the farmers aren't receiving enough money to even pay their bills. So they are providing some of the cheapness of that food, uncompensated. The rural communities that are supported by those farmers when the farmers go broke are also going down with their Main Street businesses not being supported and going broke. The planet is undergoing a great pollution of ag chemicals, and that will cost to be cleaned up at some point. And finally, the health crisis that we're in, particularly the increasing amount of chronic diseases, many of which can be linked to cheap food, is a huge bill that we're going to have to pay later than the checkout counter at the grocery store.
Well, let's talk about the food part of this here, because you have a strong sense of history about wheat and how central it once was to our diets. How about now?
Well, as a wheat grower, it's a little frustrating and insulting and embarrassing to me that 20% of the people in this country can no longer eat wheat comfortably, and many more than that dabble with wheat-free, gluten-free diets. I really puzzled over that and tried to find the reasons why that had happened over such a short period of time after wheat, referred to as a staff of life for centuries and thousands of years, and having built the Western civilizations, particularly from ancient times, now suddenly was held in such disdain and affecting people's health. And I found an ancient grain that we started growing that actually people could not only eat, but it made them feel better. And so that sent me on a quest to understand the reasons why.
This is the ancient wheat that's now got the brand name Kamut?
Yes, we've been working on that for 30 years. And from the very earliest times, when we gave samples out, people who could normally not eat any wheat at all said to me, "Wow, what is this stuff? When I eat this, it makes me feel better." And that really sent us on a trail to understand and find through research the reasons why that was.
I want to underscore that part of it. You're saying that people who had problems with eating the regular over-the-counter wheat that is generally out there now can handle Kamut, some of them anyway?
Well, about 85% in research that we've done, about 85% of the people that have severe wheat sensitivities have no trouble at all with this grain. And most of those remaining 15% have less trouble, but some of them have no difference. So the wheat sensitivity problem is quite complex. It's just not as simple as saying, well, Durham's the only culprit, because I've come to understand that there's many other factors that are probably interrelated and involved with this problem.
So if we sacrifice nutrition, what were we trying to get? I mean, what did we do in pushing wheat? What benefits did we get from the wheat that is most common now, obviously besides nutrition?
Well, price. We have in the last in the year since 1941, government statistics say that our food costs overall have dropped 61%, and wheat and bread products have led that drop. So we have very cheap and very plentiful, and that's really was the government goal, especially after World War II and seeing the famines in Europe, war-torn Europe and elsewhere in the world. They wanted to support policies and programs that provided cheap food and plentiful supply. And what they did was breed plants that yielded more, were shorter, disease-resistant, and had lots of other benefits to the farmer as far as yield goes. And then to the baker, they provided wheat that made more bread with less wheat by allowing it to rise higher in the loaf pan. And they did that by changing the gluten and making it more complex and more elastic and more able to hold more air. So the bakers now could sell more air for the price of bread. And everybody loved that.
Bob, a couple seconds up to a break here. You went organic in 1986. Was that heresy in Montana at that time?
Pretty near. I'd been in California for about 7 years before I returned, and most people thought I'd been in California too long. So they were just taking bets on how long that was going to last, whether I was going to quit first or go broke first.
Well, and you didn't. You didn't do either one of those things. Still working on the farm in Montana. Bob Quinn's book with Liz Carlisle is called Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. We'll get more into the specifics of what Bob's been doing on his Montana farm and ranch since 1986 when he went organic. He came back to the farm a little sooner than that. We'll get the full story when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Quinn and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the farming industry and how it has changed over the years. Bob Quinn saw it change one way, which he didn't think was for the better, and changed it in another way, which he thought was more authentic and more good for people in general. He's growing an ancient kind of wheat on his Montana farm and has been organic since 1986, which he just told us is kind of like heresy in that part of Montana, but it's growing on people, and he continues to grow that grain. His book with Liz Carlisle is called Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. You can join the conversation on the phone at 800-838-3760 and by email jx@jeffnet.org. Bob, there are vivid descriptions of Big Sandy, Montana, the town near the farm as you grew up. You describe such places as being depopulated by the get big or get out farm policy. Tell us about that.
Well, when I was graduating from high school, we had about 1,000 people in the town, and there were 40 in my high school graduating class. When my kids graduated from high school, there was, now there's less than 20. In the graduating classes, and the town is about 600. So that gives you just a clear example, and it's typical of what's being repeated all over rural America.
So where does the get big or get out policy come? Is it officially stated policy, or is it just sort of the effects of policies that are passed at the federal level and promulgated by big agriculture industries?
Well, it once was stated directly by one of our past Secretary of Agriculture, but the attitude preceded him and has remained after him. And the idea is to industrialize farming and agriculture in America, and also industrialize the food system so that we have giant international corporations that have wedged themselves between the farmer and the end eater, you might say, and are extracting the most of the value out of the food between us, between the farmer and the eater. And we are trying to go more direct, add more value back to the food, not only in returns to the farmer, but also nutrition and value to the buyer and the eater.
All right, so it's interesting that the word value comes in here, because it seems like the value that has been placed on the output of American farms for the last few generations has been abundance, just to make sure there's lots of food coming off those farms. And you're talking about value in a very different sense then.
Right. We'd like to see a focus, even starting with breeding programs, not just on yield, but on nutrition. I think once we relink nutrition and food and try to start observing the teachings of Hippocrates, who said that food should be your medicine and medicine should be your food, we're going to be a lot healthier and a lot more benefit will be shared by the entire food system, those who are involved with it.
Boy, Hippocrates really was the original doctor, wasn't he?
He was, and that was like 2,300 years ago.
It's amazing how far back you reach to get the stuff that's going on the farm now. Let's talk about the practices that tends to happen on larger farms, the non-organic ones, the fertilizers and the pesticides. When did their use increase to the levels it's gotten to now?
Well, they started right after World War II when the huge military-industrial complex started turning into the agricultural chemical industrial complex. And those factories that used to make bombs needed something else to do, and they started making fertilizer. And instead of poison gases, they started to make poison pesticides and fumigants and fungicides. And even though some of those were slow to be adopted, government jumped in to promote them, universities promoted them, extension people promoted them. And finally, that became the only way to farm with the vast majority of American farmers.
I want to put a very fine point on this. You're not kidding when you talk about bombs versus fertilizer, because Fritz Haber, who was the one who figured out ammonium fertilizer and won a Nobel Prize for it, then also went on to make poison gases for Germany in World War I.
Right. So they've gone back and forth a couple times, haven't they?
They really have. Your introduction to the wheat that you grow now came a long time ago at the Fort Benton County Fair. Tell us about that.
Well, it did. I was, probably a junior in high school. And I had was going to the county fair and walking into the grandstands, and this old fellow had an old Folgers red coffee can and said to me, "Hey, Sonny," he says, "come on over here." He says, "I'll give you some of King Tut's wheat." And I walked over, and he poured some of this giant grain in my hand, and I'd never seen anything so big. And the story goes that it came from an airman from our county who had been stationed in Portugal, and a friend of his he met in the bar one night claimed to have taken some grains of ancient wheat out of a tomb in Egypt and gave him some to send home to his father in near Fort Benton, Montana. And he grew it up for several years, and it became kind of a novelty in our county, and although it was over 10 years before I first saw it. But the story went around that it really was King Tut's wheat, and everybody loved it. But yet there is no commercial application for it that anybody could figure out. So after a few years, it just sort of disappeared and was forgotten.
Bob Quinn's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book with Liz Carlisle is called Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. So he picked the right person to give this sample to for a couple of reasons. One of them was that you had an attraction to science when you were young. Did you plan a career in science, or did you always plan to come back to the farm?
Well, I love plants. I love growing plants. And, of course, we were a wheat and cattle ranch, so growing plants was only half of what we did. And I really enjoyed growing plants better than I did herding cows and taking care of the cattle. But I went on to college to study science because I love science and all aspects of plant science particularly. And I was fortunate enough to receive some scholarships and fellowships. And as long as I was receiving scholarships, I just kept going to school. And 10 years later, I had a PhD and no job.
So.
Those are the days when there are lots of PhDs. There are more PhDs than were jobs for PhDs. So after having poking around for a couple of years, starting a small business of my own in California, I decided to move my family back to the farm. And soon my whole farm became my laboratory. So I continued my interest in science and another avenue.
You had a wife and three daughters by that time, as you point out. Let's get to the story about your visit to a California peach orchard, which sounded exciting to you and turned out to be a major disappointment. It sounds like it was a life-changing moment for you.
Well, it was a real eye-opener. I was in a class that I had just chose to audit It was a tour of the Central Valley of California, and stopping at major and different types of agriculture. And one of our first stops is a large peach orchard, and the peaches looked ripe and delicious on the trees and were being picked. And I just had in my mind a succulent, juicy peach, and I picked one and bit into it, and it was as green as grass, and just it tasted terrible. And I asked our professor, I said, "How can this peach look so good and taste so bad?" And he said, "This is a great advancement." He said, "We have figured out how to spray a petroleum product on these peach trees at just the right time when it causes the peaches to turn this gorgeous blush of a apparent, give the appearance of a ripe peach. But then they can be picked and shipped in bulk clear across the country with no bruising and put on the store shelves on the other side of the country and look beautiful." And yet, to me, we don't buy peaches because they look beautiful. We buy peaches because they taste great. And it was a little bit of a disappointment. It was we're pulling the wool over the eyes of our customers. And I really felt that this industrialization of agriculture now had really crossed the line. I'd never really thought about it before as anything unusual, all the industrialization and all the chemicals that we use. This really hit me right well in the mouth, in the tip of my tongue, because of the flavors and the taste now had been robbed from me. Just to make the peaches cheaper and easier to ship and more convenient for everybody.
So before long, you were back in Montana. This is the late 70s, and this is a farm that really couldn't support two families, which is your parents and your new family. Would that farm have supported two families once, though?
In former times, when the cost of farming wasn't so high with so many inputs and the cost of inputs, and also prices would be reasonable. It just had to be reasonable to be supportive when the inputs weren't so high. My dad and his brother started for a time working together, supporting two families on that farm. And yet, it was just about the time the chemicals started coming in, and a few short years and crunches in budgets really forced my uncle then to leave and to get a job in town. So it had, it was a little bit smaller then than it was at the time my father had taken it over, or the way I had grown up. But it was always on the edge. It was very comfortable for one family, but it was a little bit of a challenge for two.
So what options were you looking at to bring in income other than what the farm and the ranch could produce?
Well, a lot of my neighbors send their wives to town to work and get an extra job. We had four kids at that time. I figured my wife had a full-time job, and she was helping on the farm besides that, especially in harvest time. So I didn't see that as a viable option. So I tried to figure out how we could add value to what we're already growing, and I found a customer in Southern California who was looking for high-protein whole grain for his whole grain bakery, and we started selling direct, and that really started turning things around for us. And we went directly to bakers and sold our grain right off the farm.
Bob Quinn's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He and Liz Carlisle are the co-authors of the book Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. Bob's family farm and ranch is approaching centennial status next year, and it's in Montana, not far from the Canadian border. You can join our conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We had already talked about Hippocrates, so that took us back about 2,000 years plus. You go way back on the refinements in wheat over the years, and from the story you tell here, it sounds like we've been arguing about white bread for a very long time.
Well, the very beginnings of even in Roman times, they were, and in Greek times, there were discussion over white flour, but they didn't really have the means to make it so pure and white as we do, or as we have been able to do once the steel roller mills were invented and introduced. Then we really could make pure white flour, and we were then beginning to throw away about a third of the wheat kernel, but it was nearly half of the nutrition. And this became a very serious turn for the worst as far as nutrition from wheat goes.
So was it an evolution in yourself, though? I mean, did you eat the Wonder Bread kinds of stuff growing up? And did you think whole grain bread was just for hippies or something?
I certainly did eat the Wonder Bread because that's all there was. And, we would crush it in the balls.
I'd forgotten that part.
Yeah. It was quite fun when you could condense a whole loaf of bread into a fistful of a more solid bread. But to me, it's just like with the chemicals. I had was introduced to them almost before I can remember. That's all I knew. I didn't really think about it. And it was only after I was introduced to really artisan breads and started studying the effects of white bread and compared to whole wheat that I started thinking about it and starting appreciating it. So I never really considered it really as a hippie food exactly because I wasn't introduced to it that way in Montana, at least.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about feeding people, but as far as farming practices go, you tell us in the book that you used to think that your job was to feed the plant, and that changed to something else.
Well, that's the chemical industrial mentality. The industrial mentality is that you very carefully measure all your inputs. You look at your farm like a factory, but actually your farms are not a factory. They are living organisms made up of billions of living components. And the sooner we start looking at our farms that way, the sooner we'll stop poisoning those components that really can aid us to be successful in farming without all of these chemical inputs. And so rather than focusing on feeding the plants, an organic system focuses on feeding the soil. And we try to be regenerative in our organic approach. That means that we are constantly renewing the soil and building life and vitality into it. And that life and vitality is transferred to the plants and then eventually to the crops that are harvested and what people eat.
Feed the soil. Okay, we have a phone call here from a name sharer, Quinn in Camas Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Quinn of Grain by Grain fame.
Good morning. I got a little background. My uncle, Bob Quinn, my godfather, born in Cork City, Ireland in 1898, gassed in France in 1918, lived into his 90s.
Wow.
But I was going to say that there are strong comparisons between how you describe the development of industrial agriculture and the industrial timber industry where we live, with its tremendous amount of fairly applied chemical inputs and its disregard for environmental and ecological concerns. That's my statement. My question, how does the organic hard red winter wheat that we buy and grind ourselves, how does that stand up nutrition-wise and breeding-wise?
Okay, thanks for the question, Quinn. Appreciate it.
Well, I would say that if you can find heirloom grains or ancient wheats that haven't undergone such dramatic breeding and changing of their basic proteins and starch complexes to make a high-rising bread, that you'll be better off. You're already, if you're grinding it fresh, the next thing I would suggest is making sourdough breads using long fermentation. We know that if you use a fermentation of, say, 24 hours, like long sourdoughs might do, that 97% of the gluten is destroyed and broken down. It's pre-digested. And so people who are sort of on the edge maybe of problems with gluten, many times those problems disappear with just long fermentations that are breaking down those extra large gluten molecules. So there's several things you can do that sort of stack the deck in your favor. One is to buy heirloom wheat, if you can find them. And the next one is to use long fermentations.
So the three major parts of any wheat kernel, no matter the variety, bran, germ, and endosperm, what's the part we've been throwing away through much of the recent history of humans?
Well, it's the germ and the bran. And a little bit of some of the vitamins from that germ has been added back, some of the B vitamins, but they don't add back any of the fiber that's found in the bran, and that really helps your digestive system work right. And there's a lot of secondary metabolites and polyphenols, for example, in this germ area that are not returned to the enriched white flour. So that there really is not a, a net gain or even a close to going back to where you originally started with whole wheat with enriched white flour.
All right, so we're enriching it because we're trying to put things back in that came out in the process of preparing it.
That's right. We found in World War II when they started seeing so many young men fail the draft physicals that it was determined that most of that was because of the white flour they were eating and the lack of vitamins that were missing from that white flour that they used to have when they were eating whole wheat. And that's where the enrichment program really got kick-started and put into this thing.
The whitening of the flour actually comes from an actual bleaching process, right?
Well, that's the end result. At first, they separate as complete as possible the bran and the germ, and what's left sometimes is not as pure and white as they like it to be, so they bleach it.
Wow. Okay. Much more to learn from Bob Quinn, who with Liz Carlisle is the author of Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food, his farm and ranch in Montana. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone and email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Bob Quinn, who is a farmer in Montana, farmer and rancher, I should point out, way up in Montana, not far from the Canadian border. The farm has been in the family for nearly 100 years now, and he's turned it all organic as of 1986 and grows an ancient kind of wheat that we know commercially as Kamut. His book with Liz Carlisle is called Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. It's a conversation you are welcome to join on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking, Bob, about your decision to change the focus from not feeding the plant but feeding the soil, and the plants would take care of themselves, and that results in different approaches too to how you farm. In conventional agriculture, would you just plant wheat year after year after year?
In our part of the country, we would. Mm-hmm. Mostly. It's winter wheat country. That's what does the best. People would sometimes rotate in a little barley and sometimes a little spring wheat, but that was the limit of the rotations by and large all the time I was growing up.
How different is that with the organic process you use now?
Well, we have a 9-year rotation. So instead of two crops, the wheat and barley, we're growing 9 different crops of winter wheat. We grow ancient and heirlooms winter wheats like red fife and turkey red and sometimes spelt. We grow the Kamut brand wheat and for spring wheat. We grow high oleic safflower to make high oleic safflower oil, which we crush on our own farm too. And then we add to that alfalfa hay, Hollis barley, and sometimes purple barley, and sometimes a little buckwheat.
Now, with all those different things you're growing on the soil, though, the way you lay it out in the book, the federal subsidies would only pay for wheat. So how did you make out financially in the first 2 years of going organic on these rotations?
Well, that's true. It's not quite that. It's not that way anymore. But when we first started, there were really disincentives to go organic and to introduce rotation like we had. But we were able to reduce the cost of our inputs by 2/3, increase the value of our outputs by almost double. And so the bottom line was much better, and we started paying off operating notes that we'd never been able to do before. In about 3 years, we didn't even have an operating note anymore. The farm was doing so well, much better financially.
So this is what I consider the most instructive story of the book, though, the idea of what you have to do to be able to deal with the issues that are going to come to any farm, but do it organically. So, and it's the story of how you handled a grasshopper invasion on the farm. What did you do?
Well, the grasshopper showed up in the drought year in about 1988. And by that time, half my farm was organic and half was still chemical. And on the chemical side, we had the spray planes come in and spray very strong insecticide, malathion, on our field. We weren't supposed to even enter the field for 24 hours after that. It killed all the grasshoppers. It killed everything that was alive. But in about 5 or 6 days, or maybe 7 or 8, the grasshoppers returned. All their friends showed up. And the malathion was dissipated enough by then that they just took over where the last ones had left off. And by that time, we couldn't afford to pour good money after bad. And we had very little harvest in that field. And the combine hopper was just as much full of grasshoppers as it was full of grain from that field. And meanwhile, our organic field across the creek, we use Nosema locusta, which is a protozoa, somewhere between a bacteria and a size of a virus. And the grasshoppers ingest that on the bran that we put on. And we just put it around the edge of the field and catch the grasshoppers as they're coming in from the pastures into our wheat field. They get sick, and then all their friends eat them. I don't know where they learned that, but that's really how it spread. And it spread very, very rapidly. And even though they destroyed probably 100 feet perimeter around the field where they started to enter it, the center of the field or the vast majority of the field was spared. And at harvest time, there was almost no grasshoppers in the combine tank, and the combine tank was full of grain that had been spared. So that was the last year I used chemicals on my farm. I had tried the best that chemistry had to offer. It had failed me completely. It cost me a lot of money for that failure. And my biological control worked wonderfully, and I was a instant convert at that point.
All right, let's take a couple of phone calls here. We have Gary and Applegate on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Quinn, the author of Grain by Grain.
Yes, hello, Mr. Quinn. I was wondering about whether you plant, well, I think you did mention that you also plant spelt, and I was wondering if you plant einkorn and what you think of the nutritional value and bread-making ability of those kinds of grains.
All right, thanks for that, Gary.
Well, thanks, Gary. Well, I do experiment with all kinds of heritage wheats and ancient grains. In my experimental plots, I have einkorn and emmer and spelt, although we've only had fields of spelt. The einkorn for us yields quite low. It's a little bit sweeter to the taste. I think it makes a wonderful bread. And many of those old grains have much more intense flavors. You know, the flavors is something that have been bred out of the wheat in the effort to get high yields. And so flavors in products are sometimes sacrificed, thinking, well, we can just add flavors if we really want in the end. But those flavors are tied with the presence of polyphenols oftentimes, and they are very strong antioxidants and contribute to anti-inflammatory properties. So they have very strong health benefits. So many times the wonderful aromas that you experience and the taste that you experience when you eat the bread is actually tied to health benefits of secondary metabolites that are instilled in that wheat kernel and therefore in the whole grain if you're eating whole grain and come through in the bread.
Let's take another call here from Stuart in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Quinn.
Donna, it is. I lived in Montana near you and lived in Montana 52 years, but I lived in Haver. And about in the late 60s or 70s, there was an article in the Great Falls Tribune about a couple who were selling bread, organic bread. They had only two flavors or two kinds, very dark. It was very dense. It was called Great Harvest, and it was organic. And when we'd come from Haver to Great Falls, I'd make a point to stopping there. However, and we followed that company for years whenever we'd travel, but more and more, I don't even know of any Great Harvest bread places that have organic bread. They when I ask them about it, they seem very ignorant. So I wondered what happened. Why a business like that?
Well, that would probably be a better question to ask the Great Harvest people themselves. I know that the original franchise was sold, and it is set up to be a franchise so that each owner of each bakery can have a little bit of autonomy and do what they like. But I know that their focus perhaps isn't quite as strong on organic as it once, but some bakers really are strong on that and do carry some organic grain, and many of them carry Kamut brand flour and bread products also. But one thing in their favor, they're mostly using whole grain, so you still have that benefit. But don't be bashful about asking them to tell them you're looking for organic, if that's what you want, and ask them to consider getting some in if they don't have any. And a lot of these kind of bakers would respond if they had very many requests like that.
So not just get to know your farmer, but get to know your baker too, Donna. Thanks for the question about that. Bob, I want to ask you specifically about where you are, because we mentioned you're not very far, within 100 miles of the Canadian border, which sounds like a cold place. What is it that makes that part of Montana so good for growing the things you grow?
Well, the climate is perfect for growing wheat. It's very close to Mediterranean and Near East climates, and particularly the Mesopotamia area where wheat originated. We have cold winter, so we're planting in the spring mostly, or the winter wheat is planted in the fall, then it's winter hardy. But that wheat is off to an early start, and it takes advantage then of the spring rains. Most of our 40% of our rain comes in May and June, and then it stops raining, and it gets very hot and dry as that wheat matures. It puts it under stress and makes it high protein and very good quality. And that's what gives Montana wheat really an advantage in quality over many other wheats that are grown around the country, especially when you're talking about bread. If you're looking for soft wheat for pastries and cakes and whatnot, you don't need the high protein for that. But for bread, you need high protein to make it work right, and that's what we can do best.
Larry in Arcata sent an email in. He wants to know what external inputs and fertilizers you do use.
Okay, that's a good question. I didn't really talk about that. Going back to my 9-year rotation, I only gave you the crops that we sell for cash crops. Those are about 5 different crops, but we have 4 different crops that are sandwiched in between those 5, so that every other year we're growing a soil-building crop. And we rotate those, too, between alfalfa, sweet clover, lentils, and peas, and even buckwheat occasionally. So we are growing all of our own inputs. We don't buy any fertilizers that we bring onto our farm.
Wow, nothing. That's amazing. I want to ask about what you did in trademarking the name Kamut. Now, and it was trademark versus some other techniques you could have used. You didn't want to be like Monsanto with the seeds, I understand.
Well, I study Monsanto a lot, and I try to do everything the opposite of what they do. And they like to have ownership of everything that they produce, but they don't take any responsibility in that ownership. So they patent their seeds, and so that farmers can't even save the seeds because they're owned by somebody else. The trademark has nothing to do with the grain as it's available to grow to farmers. We really believe the grain is a gift from our Creator, and that it's free and should be free for everybody. And we don't raise a ruckus or anything if farmers want to just go out and buy some of this coarse cell wheat and plant themselves and do whatever they want with it. But if they want to be part of our Kamut project, then they grow it under contract for us, and it has to meet certain standards of quality. It has to be organically grown. It has to be a certain level of protein and free from disease and that sort of thing, so that we can guarantee the quality of the trademark. We don't charge farmers for the seed. We give the seed to the farmers on loan, and at harvest time, they just replace what they've used. So our idea is not to make money off the back of the farmers, but give them a chance to make their own money and not have it all eaten up by input suppliers.
Now, that's on the growing end. I noticed, too, that on the delivery end, in your quest against cheap fuel, cheap food, cheap labor, that you don't give volume discounts either. Why not?
Well, I like to try to give the small companies an equal chance against the big ones. And why should a big company have a price advantage over a small one and put them at a disadvantage where they can go out and force them out of business, perhaps? I'm very sensitive to that, and we first started with that policy, and some people were quite surprised because it's really not the normal thing, but I usually don't do the normal thing, and I find it more fun and sometimes more fair. And I thought it would be more fair to those who, often the small companies are the ones that take the chance in the first place to try something new. And then once they've kind of built the road, then the big companies want to come in and travel on it free of charge. And I think that's wrong, that the small companies then should be penalized because they're not able to buy big volumes after they've done all the work and taken all the risk to start new projects in the first place.
Bob, I know you traveled far and wide in support of the Kamut project in particular, including to places like Egypt, where we believe the grain originated. But is what you've done on your farm and ranch in Montana, and granted, there are going to be variations in precipitation and other weather conditions and stuff, is it replicable, do you think, across the country?
Oh, I do. I do. The principles of organic agriculture are the same all over the world. We focus on soil building, as I've already said, on diversity. The closer we can mimic nature, the more we can count on having success and sustainability and reach the goals of regenerative agriculture that I mentioned earlier. I think that organic regenerative agriculture not only has a future, it is the future. And from what I've seen from visiting organic farms in on every continent all over the world.
All right. There's just a whole lot more to the book that we didn't even get to. It is called Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. Bob Quinn, the principal author, is a Montana farmer and rancher and the owner of a PhD in plant biochemistry from UC Davis. He wrote the book with Liz Carlisle, who joined us previously to talk about Lentil Underground, which also takes place in Montana. Bob Quinn, a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today on The Exchange.